Welcome back, amigos, to episode 38 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. Before we are joined by this week's guest, I would like to briefly mention our sponsor, Amazon.com. If you want to help support this podcast, go to NatsGM.com. Click on the Amazon link on the right side of our page and do your online shopping. One more favor, if I might. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, as this helps us gather additional listeners to the show.
This is Joe Imrahi from Baseball Prospectus. Show some want. Listen to the Nats GM Show.
And now, without further ado, I am honored to welcome back to the Nats GM Show, draft guru for Perfect Game, Nick Phalaris. Nick, welcome back to the Nats GM Show.
How's it going?
It's going really well. It's good to talk to you. I got a chance to meet you and talk to you for a while at the BP Milwaukee event a couple of weeks back, and I'm glad to have you on the show just a few days before draft day. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here. Fun time in Milwaukee and fun to be back on the show here.
Well, thank you. And thank you for clearing a few minutes. I know it's, for those of the audience that don't know, it's about 11:30 right now on a Friday night. So thank you for carving out a few minutes. I appreciate it greatly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's dive in. 2015 draft is, I don't know, about two or three days away, maybe even today, depending on when everybody's listening to this. And I kind of want to start with the most general of questions. Just what are the strengths and the weaknesses of this draft class?
Well, it's a deep draft class, a really nice collection of sort of that second tier of you know, low seven-figure, high six-figure bonus valuation prospects. So lots of good high school arms, lots of up-the-middle talent. Where the draft is a little light is at the very top of the draft board. You know, Brady Aiken, number one pick last year, was eligible again this year after not signing last year. Went down with Tommy John surgery. Michael Mattiuella at Duke was a candidate entering the season to go, you know, the top five, top ten. He went down with Tommy John surgery. And Nate Kirby at Virginia has had kind of an up and down season. He's been banged up a little bit. His control has regressed. So some folks think maybe he's been battling some health issues, and he's been out for a little while now. He was scratched for this weekend's Super Regional as well. So a lot of the big names entering the draft, or entering the spring rather, have sort of fallen off due to injury. That's thinned out the top of the class. There's still some good talent there, but it's a lot more depth than it is impact at the top right now. But still, Colby Allard, the top high school arm entering the spring, he's been out. He's missed most of the spring with a back injury. So it's the top of the class took a hit, but it's a very deep class. There's a lot of worthy targets for teams that are going to be picking in the second and third round, in particular, for them to spread around their savings and be interesting to see what everyone does.
Well, is because a few of the names at the top of the draft have had kind of a rough spring. Is that why, you know, I guess the reputation or the word has been that this isn't a great draft?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. I think scouts. It's a lot more fun, and your job's a lot easier when you have those elite talents in your region that you can go out and tick off. But there are a lot of future MLB contributors in this draft class, and it's funny. While this may be less exciting draft class, if you're picking sort of in that third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh overall spot, where in previous years maybe you hope someone falls to you, or one of those elite talents falls to you, there's not a lot differentiating the guys sort of I would say outside of maybe Dansby Swanson, Brendan Rodgers, you know, maybe depending on what type of profiles you like, you could even slot Alex Bregman up there as well. It starts to drop off pretty abruptly, and then there's a really long plateau of talent. So you're going to have a lot of teams that actually are better off with a class like this because they're going to have a higher quality of talent available to them when they're picking in the second round, when they're picking in the third round. It's the teams up top that really are missing out on having those elite talents there because their price tag drops, they drop further in the draft, and there are more teams that can go after them. So overall, this draft class is probably better for most major league teams, and it's a less exciting draft class for some of the teams picking at the top. Although there's obviously nuance there as well, which we can get into a little later at the end if you want to go down that.
Well, I definitely want to, and you named kind of three names that I wanted to talk to you about, particularly all the three shortstops, you know, Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman, and Brendan Rodgers. Maybe just break them down real quickly and kind of your thoughts on where their future, you know, particularly defensively, may lie.
Sure. Swanson, for me, the top guy in the draft class. He was a second baseman at Vanderbilt up until this year, and actually last summer at Team USA, he started the transition over to shortstop. So as an underclassman, he played second base. This year he shifted over to shortstop and really availed himself well at the position. He moves well laterally, good hands, finishes well at the margins of the zone. So his effective range, you know, is right there in lockstep with his with the more traditional thought of range, just can he get to the ball? And then effective range would be when he gets there, can he complete the play? So it was going to be a good defensive shortstop, above average shortstop, good arm strength, left side arm, you know, capable of making the throw on the outfield grass in the hole. So he's got everything you need defensively. He's sold scouts on his ability to stick at shortstop. And he can hit. I mean, he's one of the best hit tools in the draft class. It's a nice, clean swing. He generates backspin and carry. He drives the gaps well. He's shown even more power this year than he has in the past. Could be an average power bat, a 60-hit tool. You know, it's a chance to be a real impact player and to do it pretty quickly, you know, pretty quickly. So that's the number one guy if I had to line all three of them up. Brendan Rodgers, the top high school kid in the class, and I think who most people have had on the top of their draft board, myself included, for most of the year, a little bit more power than Swanson. This is the guy who's already probably above average to plus raw power guy, and the power is him to getting all the way there as plus playable power as he continues to mature and refine his approach. Depending on who you talk to, some people think that the hit tool is anywhere from fringe average to plus, and a lot of it is going to depend on how he continues to develop as a hitter. He can get a little aggressive now. There are some holes there that he hasn't quite figured out how to close up, but on the showcase circuit, travel ball, he's performed well. Generally, he's one of the more well-known prep players in the class, so scouts know what they're getting. Everyone's got their opinion formed on him. Some people think he has a chance to pick a shortstop long-term. I think he might be a better fit at third base. So you may be looking at someone who's either an above average to plus defender at third base or a fringe average defender at shortstop. And, we'll see how that range and that first step comes along as he continues to hang muscle because he's got some more room in his frame to get stronger. So, he's a third base / shortstop, middle of the order type bat, typical high school risk. He's not a pure hitter, but he's a high upside hitter. And then Alex Bregman has been at the top of this draft class for the last, this will be the third year. He was one of the best hitters in the country as a freshman. Had a little bit of a backslide last year, but came back this year and has really swung the bat well. He's got some sneaky power for a guy who's a little bit on the smaller side, but really finds the ball at the barrel consistently. One of the better field hitters in that breaking stuff inside outside, has a good job of going with the pitch, drives the gaps effectively, And you know, the comp that he gets, the most often gets dumped on him is Dustin Pedroia. I get it. He's sort of an undersized college shortstop that was a good hit tool that, you know, a lot of people projected to shift across the bag to second base and be a good defender there. I think he's got a chance to stick at shortstop. He plays the position aggressively. He doesn't have the range or the arm that Swanson has, but he's very sure-handed. Some of the best hands you'll see. Feels everything, running through the ball, moving through the ball and towards first base, which helps to mitigate the fact that the arm strength isn't a true plus. It's a case of, it'll probably depend on what organization ends up with it. If you have an organization that's a little bit more flexible with what they allow at shortstop and what they want to have at shortstop, you can stick there long term. He's probably a better traditional fit at second base, but his calling card's going to be the bat. So those are the three up the middle talents. In order of likely to stay at shortstop, you know, Swanson definite, Bregman maybe, Brendan Rodgers maybe, and I'd go in that order. And then offensively, Rodgers has the best upside. Swanson's right there in the middle, and Bregman's probably the surest thing as far as pure hit tool.
And where do you see them going on Monday evening?
I mean, I think certainly in the top seven. Swanson, I'd be shocked if Swanson didn't go one overall. I guess it'll come down to how hard a game he wants to drive with Arizona, as far as do they think that he's going to be a really difficult sign, or do they think that they can get it done for a reasonable amount? And, you know, as impressive as Swanson is, this is an $8 million guy. So the question is how much is he going to require for Arizona to get comfortable enough to go after him with the first pick? Bregman, anywhere in the top four, I could see Bregman going as early as two. I don't think he goes one over Swanson. He's certainly not going to. I can't imagine him falling lower than Boston at seven. And Brendan Rodgers, likewise, he's going to be off the board in the first four picks. I can't imagine the Rangers would pass on him. And more likely than not, I think he ends up going either first or second. He's probably not going to go first. Arizona seems more on Swanson if they're going to go the position player route, the middle infielder route. But he could go second to Houston. If Colorado doesn't want him a pitcher, he can certainly go third. And I don't think he goes past Texas. So three shortstops could all go in the top four picks, certainly all off the board in the top seven.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, particularly to see two college shortstops going off the board in the top, you know, whatever, seven, is pretty amazing. So,
yeah, it's a lot of depth. And then you've got, you know, other potential first-rounders, you know, Kevin Newman at Arizona, he's got a chance to go in the first round, Richie Martin at Florida. His family, you talk to, some folks think Mikey White could sneak into the back half of the first round or the supplemental first round, Lake Tron, Louisiana Lafayette. So there are a ton of high school, current high school shortstops that probably project more to end up at third base or second base. But there are going to be a lot of middle infielders. And then if you want to bring in the second baseman, obviously Ian Happ, who's been in the outfield with Cincinnati. He started his career at second base there, and a lot of folks want to see him return there as a pro. Scott Kingery at Arizona. So there's a ton of middle infield talent in the class this year. It's one thing for organizations to get excited about.
Okay, now let me try to shift to the mound if I can and kind of help you, or have you help me walk through this minefield of kind of what's going on at the top of the draft. It seems like the top three pitchers all have a potential to be relievers in Tyler Jay, Dylan Tate, and Carson Fulmer, at least on the college side. Kind of your thoughts on them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think all three of those players have their proponents who are dead set on the fact that they think that player is going to start long term. So if that's the top three arms on your draft board, you know, Fulmer started this year for Vandy. He pitched very well. His issue is really consistency and execution and command and control. And so the question is he precise enough with his stuff, and can he maintain it deep into games and on 5 days rest? know, if he were to end up in the pen, he would be a potentially impactful arm in the late innings, someone who could help out at the major league level very quickly. He's getting tied to Houston by a lot of people. I think some of that is Houston's, you know, expressed interest, Houston's presence at his games. It's also just sort of trying to reason out how Houston might approach this. So if they go with Bregman, or assuming Swanson goes first overall, if they go with Bregman at number two, they go with Brendan Rodgers at number two, maybe they go after Fulmer, seeing him as a slightly easier sign at five, and then free up a little bit of money for their supplemental pick to go after one of the bigger guys that, that might fall at the names there. You know, Daz Kammer is probably the most well-known name that the folks think could end up sliding down later in the draft because of his bonus demand. So, yeah, those three arms, Tyler Jay's relief pitcher, multi-year relief pitcher of Illinois, he has yet to start. I mean, he technically started a game earlier this year, but his career at Illinois has been as a reliever. He was reliever at Team USA. For me personally, I just don't know how you get comfortable projecting him out as a starter, having never seen him start and not having any clue what it looks like with him throwing, you know, that many innings once a week. Even in college, you don't know what it looks like with a week's rest, let alone 5 days rest. He's going to end up, I think, throwing around 60 to 65 innings this year, somewhere in that range. You're going to want to build him up to, you know, 180 innings before he's promoted to the majors, probably, I would imagine. You've got a little bit of the summer to continue to build that arm strength, but those are just a lot of questions. You know, from my personal preference as far as player profiles and how you see risk distributed, that's a lot to take on for a top five pick for, you know, someone that you might be giving $3 million, $4 million, $5 million to. That's an awful lot of trust. And then Tate at UCSB had a great start to the year, faded some, came back at the end of the year and had a nice start to cap off the season, one of the more electric arms in the class. You know, same question. We saw him fade a little bit this year. And that was, you know, going on a week's rest, what does it look like over a much longer season with 5 days rest? And there's time to build up the arm strength, but yeah, all three of those arms are impressive, have the chance to be really impactful, but come with a fair amount of questions.
Yeah. Okay, two other pitchers I got to ask you in the two biggest wild cards in the draft, Brady Aiken and Michael Matuella. Your thoughts on them and kind of where you see them landing, you know, perhaps in the draft?
Yeah, so Aiken is really going to come down to what folks think about the medicals that he provides. And so Kylie McDaniel at Fangraphs, like, was the first person that I saw talk about this. Apologies to someone else who's the person who broke the story. I haven't been able to keep up really with what everyone's writing on the draft over the last days. But so Aiken, it sounds like Aiken's people are making medicals available on a case-by-case basis rather than, you know, normally it would be submitted to Major League Baseball and uploaded to a database and anyone who's interested could pull it. The way that it's being managed this time is you contact Aiken and let them know you'd like to see it, and then they're going to be made available at, I want to say it was the GM level and above. So essentially, you know, teams can have the medicals delivered to the GM, and the GM's allowed to show it to anyone who's involved in the decision-making process. But basically, it sounds like Aiken's camp is trying to minimize, you know, getting the medicals out to too many people. You can read into that whatever you want. What it's going to come down to is we'll know, you know, when we see where he goes in the draft, we'll know sort of what to think about those medicals. You know, I doubt anyone gets the details of this anytime soon, but if he ends up going out in the late first round and is signable for $2 million or so, you know, there's at least one team out there that isn't completely scared off. If we're going towards the end of day two and he's still on the board, that means that whatever it is on there, especially with all the extra money that we'll have while you're on this draft. If no one is willing in the first round for they to run at them, it's got to be something pretty far out there. So,
and what do you have any speculation on what it might take to sign him? I mean, not that you have any insider knowledge, but just any thoughts?
Well, as a general matter, you know, to the extent that I hear actual numbers, I don't, as a practice, discuss those publicly until after the draft, until the draft's been completed. There's you know, a fair amount of incentive for both camps to float numbers either a little high or a little low. And to be honest, I just don't like getting caught up in perpetuating any of those thoughts. Guessing completely on my own, you know, I think a reasonable estimate is you're talking about an arm that is, I would say, would be considered by most to be the top or one of the top two talents in this draft class that's healthy. Pretty good track record. You know, there's precedent out there from anywhere from $2 million to $3.5 million. Given that we know there's some sort of structural uncertainty as far as some quirks with how that his elbow is put together, maybe you dock it a little more and say, you know, two to two point five as a reasonable target, and then maybe it goes up or goes down a little bit depending on the specifics of the negotiation. So I think he fits in well at the really anywhere from the, you know, early teens to the late first round, and you know, if the right team likes him and doesn't think that the medical is particularly troubling, he could be a top 10 guy. I mean, I don't think he ends up there, but someone like a good fit would be with the Dodgers. I think they traded for some extra money, traded for the Orioles. What was it, their third round pick or their supplement there?
74. Yeah, second round comp, whatever that is. Yeah.
So they picked up like another $500,000 or $600,000 there that they can tack on to their 25th or 24th overall pick, whichever I'm blanking on which one it is. And you know, that extra money that they have, if you go to the $500,000, can go a long way towards getting you to that 2.5 million mark. And you know, if someone like Arizona or Colorado were so incentivized, they're going to have enough extra money. Houston's the only other team that could really hang with them in this department. You know, they would have the money to give him $3 million, $3.5 million, $4 million. And you know, the rumors right now around Daz Cameron that he's going to be asking for a fair amount of money. And he's another one who, if you know, he could be someone who's identified or with help of his advisor or his, you know, him himself identifying or whatever it is, you know, to be coming up with sort of this approach. There are going to be a couple teams at the top of the draft that have an insane amount of money. You know, if I'm confident that they're interested in me, I can basically make myself available for them. And if the slot, you know, if their pick comes around and they're sitting on a couple extra $1 million, and I was in the top five or top eight of their draft board, and I'm going to be available, you know, in the 30s or the 40s, I'm going to take a bet that they're going to pick me and make a run at me. You know, Aiken could be in the same boat there. If he can get comfortable that a team is interested and has a little bit of extra money, he could you know, angle himself depending on how he presents himself. He could let it be known basically that, you know, he's looking for a specific number, and he can do that if he's confident that there's a team out there that can get him that number.
Now, is Matuello a similar situation, or are his medicals make him a different situation?
It doesn't really come. Well, the answer is the medicals make it a different situation, but not because of the elbow. It's because he's had, you know, issues with injury over the last two seasons. So this is someone who actually doesn't really have much of a track record at all. He had some really, really eye-popping performances last spring. Really put himself on the radar as a potential top pick, and then missed, you know, a good portion of last year with back issues. sat out the summer to rest his back, so folks didn't get to see him with on the Cape. I think he was supposed to go to the Cape. I don't think he was in consideration for the USA Collegiate National Team, but skipped out on the Cape, and then this spring didn't get to show much this spring before he was shut down and had Tommy John surgery. So, whereas I look at Aiken, and if you're comfortable with the medicals, I can see an argument. He's precedent for, $2.5, $3 million. Machuola is really, to my mind, if I'm a team considering him and getting ready to sit down at the negotiating table, he's starting a lot closer to where Fetty was last year. And Fetty has a much better track record. So, I don't know that I even go as high as the Nationals went for Fetty. For Machuola, that's me personally. Obviously, there are teams out there who like him as a potential number one overall in this draft class, and maybe they're willing to put $2 million on the table and have him walk away from it. But given the fact that he's got such a limited track record and that he's really battled injuries a fair amount over the last 2 years, that to me that raises questions about durability. It raises questions about just in general his ability to stay healthy, not just perform, continue to perform as a starter with a hard workload, but just stay on the field at all. And in any event, he's not this isn't a refined college arm. This is a guy that's going to have a fair amount of development still ahead of him. He's got, mid-90s fastball that can get up and play in the upper 90s regularly. He's got a curveball, a slider, a changeup, depending on what day you see him, could flash above average, or could be below average pitches. There's just a lot of inconsistency, and he hasn't logged that many innings. So, to me, he's much more of a project. There's a lot more risk, and I see him as more of an arm that you target maybe in the supplemental first round, early second round, and maybe you make a run at him for. For me, I'd probably tap out at $1.5 million, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's a team out there willing to get $1.5-2 million just off the fact that he's got such an electric arm, and maybe they view it as someone who's malleable that they can kind of shape in their own developmental system, since he hasn't really logged that much developmental time in college. I think 140 innings or so, something like that.
Would you take the gamble, or would you shy away?
I don't think that I would. I mean, I guess there's always a point where you would. If it's the fourth round and I'm sitting on some extra money, or even if I'm not sitting on extra money, if I thought I could get in by going cheap in the back half of the top 10 rounds and piecing together $400,000-$500,000, if that on top of my fourth round allotment gets me Machuola, then I make a run at him there. But like I said, this is a deep draft class. There are a lot of worthy players that, I'd probably rather give seven figures to and feel more comfortable giving seven figures to. So my guess is I wouldn't end up selecting him, but so there's always the right set of circumstances. He's not off my track, or he's not the one that I'd say, I'm not going near that guy with a 10-foot pole. I just think that they're probably going to be, no matter what spot you put me at and who comes off the board before then, my guess is another team is going to end up popping in before I run out of options that I consider to be preferable.
That makes sense. Most of the people that will be listening to this are either Orioles or Nationals fans, so I just kind of wanted to get your general thoughts on what you think. Very different drafts. I know the Orioles have, 25, 36, and 69 on day one, and the Nats have two second rounders. Just any thoughts on their general, what you think they might do or approach on draft day?
As far as what they might do, I think the Nationals are well positioned at the major league level. I think they're going to take the best player available. They don't have a pressing need in the system. They don't have a pressing need at the major league level right now. For example, if they were in desperate need of bullpen help, and they thought, finding a college arm they could plug in there was the solution. They don't, they've got solutions for the most part internal for any major league needs that might pop up. They're going to take the best person available on the board. They don't have a huge pool on. And so the question I think that that's most interesting is, are they going to shrink down this draft to, you know, a couple more aggressive picks at the expense of, you know, going cheap with a sixth rounder and a fifth rounder and saving some cash and making a run at one, maybe two, low seven figure guys in the second and third round? Or do they take a more balanced approach? Hey, we're going to, you know, there's a fair amount of college talent draft. We get target guys that we can get for solid slot amount, and you know, just take it, just sort of take what the draft gives us. I think that they could go either way, but they're, you know, they're going to be guys I think that they can make a run at, and they're going to do what they've done the last, you know, two or three years, which is look for opportunity to leverage the situation that they're in. If there's a guy who drops due to injury, they're going to jump on. There's someone who maybe is a slightly more difficult time that they really like, they're going to find a way to put the money together and get them. So I think they're going to be aggressive. I think they're going to, you know, as they have recently, do a good job of identifying talent and going after it aggressively. Baltimore is a slightly different scenario. They, I think they have a pretty stark need. You know, they need bats in their system. The class offers a good number of bats, good depth with the bats, and then there are also obviously some power arms to mix in there. I think Baltimore is going to be, you know, leaning college, leaning bats early on. I think those are the best fits. And then the question is, do they want to get aggressive with someone like a Kep Brown, high school outfielder who blew out his Achilles and is swinging the bat again? One of the better power bats in the draft class, you know, had swing and miss issues on the scouting circuit, travel ball, but makes some of the hardest contact in the draft class. He's a good student of the game. He's a good student of just the art of hitting. He puts in a lot of cage time. Really impressive bat, potential impact bat, but a fair amount of work to do. He actually reminds me a little bit of Chris Bryant when Chris Bryant was a high schooler. I like his swing a little better than I liked Bryant's swing actually in high school, but both of them have similar plate coverage issues. Both good athletes, big time power. Bryant went to San Diego, made a lot of adjustments with his swing over 3 years. It really developed, put in the work to develop into a quality hitter. I think Kep Brown has the potential to do the same thing. I think he's actually a little bit better suited than Bryant was to go the pro ball route. So, you know, the question there is, what's his number to sign him away from Clemson? I think he'd be Clemson to sign him away from Clemson. You know, if I can get him for $1.5 million in like the third round or something like that, I'd definitely make a run at that. I'd love to see the Orioles do something like that. Go with, you know, one of the slot value or slightly below slot value bats in the first round and their supplemental pick. Maybe, a slot pick for the second round pick, and then make a run at Kep Brown in the third. That would be a great great haul for Baltimore. They could drop three or four quality bats into their system. I think that would go a long way.
Yeah, they have a stark need for bats in that system. I mean, aside from Reyes and Cisco, there's just not much there. So I think you're dead on with those. So
yeah, I mean, you know, Chris Shaw at Boston College, one of the bats I really like. He performed well on the Cape. You know, most media sites have him as kind of a second round talent. I think because he's got that corner profile, he might be relegated to first base. You know, there's a lot of pressure on the bat. If Baltimore were to get aggressive with someone like Shaw, you know, confident that, you know, he's most likely to go out in the supplemental first or second round. Maybe it only takes $1.5 million to sign him. You pop them at 25, you save $500,000 or so, and you go after someone like Joe McCarthy at Virginia, who missed a big chunk of the season, but is a great defensive right fielder, great arm, and a really talented offensive player. He's got some upside. There's a risk there that can bring down the price. If you get him for, you know, $1.5 million or so, you save $700,000. That gets you most of the way to Kep Brown right there. Then in the second round, you fill in with some of your outfield needs. Go after someone like Kristen Stewart at Tennessee, Andrew Stevenson at LSU could be a great value in the second round. You know, hit well on the Cape. plus the plus plus runner, plus the plus plus defender in center field, a little bit of Jacoby Ellsbury in him. Not quite Ellsbury's field for hitting. Ellsbury put up some pretty sick numbers at Oregon State, but Stevenson is a good hitter in his own right, aggressive hitter. He fits the game and the direction of the game right now, which is leaning more towards aggression paying off over patience. There are a lot of good college talents in that sort of 25 to 75 pick overall range that Baltimore could really they go a lot of different directions. We'll see how they leverage their opportunities. It'd be interesting to see if they had that pick they traded away, what other opportunities that might have afforded them. I don't know.
Yeah, I really wish they had kept that, because that would have made their draft class even that much more exciting. But it is what it is, I suppose. Before I let you go, last question for you is, who are some of your favorites in this draft class? And I hate the word sleepers, but who are a couple of maybe day two players that you like as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard for me to identify sort of a sleeper type, because I never know what scale we're using. Most of the guys in the class that you would consider going out in the top 2-3 rounds, I would assume that if you're following a draft, you're aware of these guys. I mean, some of the players that maybe are a little further down the board, from what I've seen, public rankings. I'm a big fan of, I mentioned a couple more. Chris Shaw at Boston College, some of the best power in the class. I think if he actually is around, pick 45, 50, 55, that's a ton of value you could get there. Big left-handed power. There's a little bit of length to the swing, but he handled the barrel well. He makes contact. I really like Shaw. I mentioned Andrew Stevenson at LSU. I think there's a little bit of risk with the hit tool. He's not a pure hitter, but he's got a good feel for contact. And as I said, he goes up there really looking to hit the ball. He can use the whole field, and I'm big on foundational value. You've got someone who runs the base as well, the plus plus runner, and then on top of that, he's a plus the plus plus defender in center field. It's a profile that could be worth 1.5, 2 wins off of the base running and the defense. And so if he's a replacement level bat, even, you're talking about a useful major league player. There's a lot of high school arms that'll probably drop down in the draft because they know that they can get the million dollar bonus. We go through some of those power arms if you want. I think Dallas Baptist, Brandon Koch, the righty from Dallas Baptist, big fastball, big slider. He's someone who I haven't really seen mentioned much in the early rounds. I guess he's a reliever. He's going to be a pure reliever at the major league level, but fastball can get up to the mid-90s, one of the better sliders in the draft class, maybe the best slider in the draft class, and could shoot up to the majors in short order. So that's someone who I like as a, if someone's looking to maybe save a little bit of money, interesting target in the second round if you can get him for third-round money there. There are a lot of other relievers like Josh Forbes at Virginia, Ryan Burr at Arizona State. There are a handful of college power relievers that are really interesting, sort of in that third round range. There's a senior at Nevada, Austin Beiler, who's a big power guy. Because he's a senior, he doesn't have tons of leverage negotiating. He's someone from a talent perspective, probably like a third to fifth rounder, and third might be a little bit aggressive for him, to be honest. But if you're looking to fill a need with power, and you've seen him good, he could be an interesting pick a couple rounds early. If you pop him in the second, third round at a huge savings, that frees up a ton of money if you want to make a run at one of the elite talents that drop down. I guess you went to a couple Maryland games this year. Brandon Lowe, the second baseman, very solid hit tool, potentially an above average hit tool. That's really the carrying tool. Not a great runner. steady defender, not a great defender. I mean, you're probably talking about a hit first and maybe even hit only second baseman. But that's, to me, that's an interesting target in the as early as the third round. I think profile wise, most would probably have him as a fourth round or fifth round pick. What did you think of Lowe?
I loved him. I mean, that's kind of my, I hate using the word cheese ball because that's not my cliche, but that's my guy for this year, and he and Justin Garcia down at Nova Southeastern, those are kind of my two guys. But
okay.
But Lau, I just, like you said, I think he plays a solid second base, nothing flashy. He's not a great runner, but he does everything right with the bat. I never see him really off balance. I just really think he's going to hit, and like you say, because of the profile, I think you can get him, you know, fourth, fifth round, decent money, and I think he hits his way to some type of career in the majors. Maybe not, you know, a distinguished one, but I think he gets there.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way about Rhett Wiseman at Vandy.
Yeah, that's a good call too. I like him.
Yeah, he's played right field. He's probably a left fielder at the professional level. He's a little over aggressive in some facets of his game. You'd like to see him rein it in a little bit, but at the same time, this spring he kind of exploded from a power perspective. He you know, as an amateur, hit the ball, stung the ball, he's still an amateur, as a high school player, most projected him to go to Vandy and develop some power. He didn't really do that the first 2 years. And he hit better on the Cape this past summer, but there was really the spring where the power started to develop, and he sold out a little bit for it, and that's how he got to it. You know, he drops the shoulder a little bit. He really looks to yank the ball, but got such solid bat speed and ability to pick pitches in his kill zone, right, in the quadrants where he can really attack it. He's done a better job more often than not finding that this spring. And, you know, you'd like to think, like, hey, maybe this is, a middle-of-the-order impact guy. I don't think he's that. But you could have, you know, an average hit tool, average power, and that's probably a little light in left field. But I'd gladly take a run at him in the third round. Certainly, if he's there in the fourth round, that's a great value there. And you might end up with sort of that Preston Tucker type, not the impact major leaguer, but someone who's a valuable piece that you can spot in there. So there's so many names that are interesting one way or another. It's not sort of these sexy dozen elite talents, but a lot of guys that you would be very happy grabbing in the second round, and if they're around in the third or fourth round, you're ecstatic to get them. There are going to be a lot of teams getting a lot of players that really like at spots they like.
Yeah, I'm glad I've had you on, because I've been trying to beat this drum that this draft is not bad as the pundits are trying to tell everybody, or the scouts are trying to tell the pundits. This is a good draft. It just may not have the Bryce Harper or Steven Strasburg type stick out, but there are a lot of really, really good players in this draft. Particularly day two is going to have a lot of good players.
Well, and it's, you know, there aren't a lot of players in this draft class who have been studs for, you know, multiple years leading up to the draft, right? So we ran into this a little bit in 2012, where it wasn't quite as strong a hum as we have this year, but 2012 there were a fair number of people who were, you know, lamenting the quality of the draft class. They were coming off that 2011 class that everyone was so enthralled with. I mean, that class obviously had Cole and Rendon and Sonny Gray came out of that class, Lindor, Baez, Jose Fernandez, it was a historic class. Everyone was excited. The last class under the old rules. People loved that class, and I loved that class. I thought that was probably my favorite class to cover of all time since I've been covering the draft. The 2012, you know, there was sort of a letdown. The media reported there being, you know, this isn't anywhere near what it was last year, and 2013 looking a little bit better. And look at who the 2012 class gave us. I mean, I think it's given us five of the top seven current prospects in baseball, right? It was Correa was in that class. Corey Seager was in that class.
Buxton.
Yeah, Buxton was in that class. Albert Almora was in that class. He's a top 100 guy right now. Kevin Gausman was in that class. Papel went in that class. I had a list of these. Giolito was in that class. David Dahl was in that class.
Yeah, he's exploding. Gosh.
Yeah, I got to go back and look at it because I think I ended up counting something like 15 or 16 names that were either current top 100 prospects or had already reached the major leagues. Stroman was in that. Stroman was 2000.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But it, you know, at the time, it was sort of the same type of thing. There wasn't anyone that people really loved. And there was a lot of debate. You know, Buxton sort of emerged as everyone really feels like he's kind of a top guy in the class. And Correa and Perfect Game, I think, actually might have been the only source I remember who was beating the Correa drum as this is a legit top of the draft class guy. And again, Correa was new to a lot of scouts. Sort of made some good showings on the scouting circuit. Showed really well in Jupiter, and you know, a couple of showcases over the winter. But wasn't a known commodity coming into the draft season, and ended up being a really savvy pick by the Astros there. If freed up the money for him to go and sign Lance McCullers, he's been phenomenal in his first few starts at the majors here. So
yeah.
Go back. You should definitely go back and check it out. Anyone listening to this, go pull up the 2012 draft class and look at the folks selected in the first three rounds there. You're going to be shocked at how many names there are relevant and exciting names in the game right now. And so that's what I think about, you know, stepping through all that. It's just something that I keep in mind with respect to this class. I mean, there's a lot of high school talent. There's a lot of talent that, you know, could go either way. They're going to – it's harder to identify which of these players is going to develop into, you know, that big-time prospect and future producer. But there will be a good collection of players from this class. It's just a matter of, you know, are we able to identify who that player is going to be? And that can be frustrating for scouts too, because what you're really looking for, right, when you're submitting players, what you want is that guy that you're in love with and you can stand up and back him and fight for him, you know, passionately. If this is my guy and he's going to succeed, there are not a lot of players that you look at and you can, as an evaluator, say I don't have very many concerns about this guy. Most of the players that in this class have you know, along with their potential, have warts, and that's you know, I guess I see the point that maybe that's an argument for being weaker. I disagree with that. I think majority of draft classes, any amateur player, you're gonna be able to come up with reasons why they might not succeed. And when you and I mean at the very beginning of this, when we went over, you know, the folks, the three of you listed as the top three arms in the class, sort of by consensus, all three of them have pretty big concerns as far as will they or will they not even stick as starters long term. So, you know, it's not a class chock full of surefire things, but there are so many interesting names in the class that I'd be surprised if we didn't turn around in 3 years and say, wow, there's a lot of talent that came out of this draft class.
And I think conversely, we're going to look at the guys that miss and we're going to say, you know, we should have seen that Dylan Tate was going to be a pure reliever, or so-and-so had never started, or I think it's going to be unique looking back on it in a few years in that respect, too.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that you know, the really deep high school outfield class, we're going to see that there were, as always, I mean, when something goes wrong, you can point to, like, concerns that you had at the time, and when things go right, you can point to the fact that you liked it. Those aspects of the play. It's kind of the beauty of hindsight when it comes to the draft and amateur players. It's not usually the trick isn't identifying what the risk is and what the upside is. It's trying to put a number on it, right? It's trying to figure out
exactly right
what's the probability and what's this player going to look like once we work with him, and how is he going to implement that instruction? How is he get, you know, what's the drive? How is he going to handle life with baseball as a job and not just something that you're doing as one aspect of your life. It's your 9-to-5. And how's he going to cope with the pressures and all that stuff? I mean, these are all things that really, this is where the area scout makes his money, you know, getting to know the player, getting to know the makeup, and taking all that and using that as the lens to view the profile. And then all those decision makers up top get to get to sit down and try and sift through this. So I guess one thing that I'm probably most looking forward to, now that I kind of rambled through that, is there are so many different directions that so many teams could go. You know, there's a good chance that the top 50 picks in the draft look nothing like, and I mean, oftentimes, you know, there are picks that don't jive with sort of consensus rankings, and the idea of consensus rankings with the draft is kind of silly. But I mean, it could look like, you know, throwing darts at a dartboard compared to the draft rankings when we start day two and we look at what order these names come off the board. I mean, we could have guys outside the top 100, guys in the bottom of you know, various sites, top 100s, going in the first 15 picks or on the first, you know, 25 picks. There's not a ton separating sort of that big second tier of talent in the class. So I'm really interested to see what teams are doing, how they're going to approach having sort of this deeper class where it might only take, you know, 200, 300,000 extra to sign. Are players going to be taking harder lines and trying to maneuver themselves to the teams with deeper pockets? I don't know. I'm fascinated. I can't wait to see how it kind of all unfolds on Monday and I guess for the first half of day two as well.
Well, that's a perfect place to stop. So, Nick, where can we find you on draft day? Spot for your plugs where everybody can find you on Twitter and all that good stuff.
Yes, Twitter is Nick J. Falaris, F-A-L-E-R-I-S. Draft day will be on MLB Network Radio. I think noon Eastern is when I'm joining them there. And then most likely will be participating with the Perfect Game folks. They've got the last couple of years, that's where I've been as far as chatting goes. They've got all day chat going at Perfect Game, and good collection of guys there, four or five guys that you know, live and breathe amateur baseball. Some of the smartest guys you'll talk to, really insightful, and great collection. So I'm sure everyone is going to have, you know, two or three different chats open and flipping between everyone's last mock draft and all that stuff. But definitely put Perfect Game on the list of sites to check out and spend part of your draft day with.
Yeah, nobody does the college game or the draft any better than Perfect Game is doing right now. I mean, Nick and you know, Patrick, and just so many great guys doing so much great work over there. So I'm sure we'll check you out on MLB Radio, and definitely check you out at Perfect Game on Monday.
All right, appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Thanks for tolerating my rambling once again.
Oh, and believe me, thank you for carving out some time for me tonight. I greatly appreciate it, and thank you for being such a good host in Milwaukee as well. I had such a great time talking baseball with you and getting to meet you.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do it again sometime for sure. And if you can tolerate my rambling, I'll come on the show for a third time.
Open invitation whenever you want to come on.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. And that was my conversation with Perfect Game's Nick Falaris. Obviously, you can tell he is a MLB draft guru. I mean, he is just incredibly smart and good with these players. So thank him for joining me on a Friday night into a Saturday morning now. So thank you so much to him. With that, episode 38 is a wrap. Bye for now.